Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi.
Brian Brushwood.
Apple TV is going to be great. Mark my words.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody.
Gentlemen, I'm going to jump right into a mystery with y'all.
Go.
I want you to imagine that you have, I don't know, like a little work shed in your backyard. Okay. On there, there's a bench. At night, maybe you work on projects. Brian, maybe you're designing the next puzzle box.
Sure.
Justin, maybe you're making, you know, porcelain clay wrestling figures.
As I'm wont to do.
Bryce, you like to put together watches or something. Whatever.
Oh, yeah. Big watch. You have to,
watch Bryce the watchmaker. You've got your little tools and stuff and your little box you open up. You take your tools out during the day and you go work on it and fix things and make things. And then, you know, when you're done, you just leave everything there. Okay. You leave the shed, close the shed, take a lock, close the lock on the shed, go to bed. Wake up the next day. Pull the key out, unlock the lock on the front of the shed, take it, put it on the hasp, open the door. Go inside. Now, you remember the night before when you were working on your project, your respective projects?
Sure.
Justin, you had, yeah.
I mean, I only made it like halfway through the assembly. I only had like two of the sides built on the box.
I barely sculpted the bicep on my porcelain clay wrestling figure.
I'm still figuring out the 60 seconds thing. I don't. One day.
Now, you look at the bench. And it's clean.
I mean, you don't see your... did an errant wind blow through? Where's my stuff?
You look at the box where you keep your tools and you open it up, and there are all your tools back in the box and some little parts and stuff.
I mean, this is not unlike what happens in my actual life. I usually attribute it to one of three magical creatures named Bryce, John, and Brant. And I just assume.
Understand, only you have a key to the shed and you live alone because it's just a sad turn of events, but we don't get into that.
Okay.
Maybe you forgot. Next night you go work on your tools and you leave them out. You go leave the shed, lock the shed, go to bed, wake up next day, come back, unlock the shed, walk up to your bench. Same thing.
So the project remains, but the tools are put away.
The tools are everything. All the little parts, everything next to it, all the little parts and stuff are back in the box next to it.
So, but the project itself is still there.
I mean, if it's a little thing, it's everything that fits in the box is back in the box. Your little figure is back in the box.
So there is nothing on the bench when I walk.
No,
back.
Nothing in that area. Everything's back inside the box.
All right. Is this a home workshop? Like I'm living alone and this is at my home?
Very alone. Very lonely.
All right. In this scenario, do I currently have a prescription to Ambien?
By the way, we are still at the point where Brian is not shocked at all. Like, these are all the things that have definitely continued to happen.
You do not have a subscription to
a
other
subscription.
Brian.
I like that.
Ambien
to
Plus.
Other Brian. Other Brian.
Is a very weak vacuum somehow manifesting itself inside my shed?
Well, the real trick is that the tools end up where they belong, and which violates one of Newtonian laws of physics, thermodynamics.
Yeah, the fourth law of tools.
Yes, exactly. It's always in the last place you look.
Exactly. It is not tool time.
So that means there has to be an intelligent actor of some variety. Wait a minute. This is the Weird Things podcast. Okay, I don't know how well-trained snakes are.
Thank you for remembering, Brian.
It's got to be a critter. It's got to be a trained critter. Hold on. What part of the world am I alone working on this thing in?
England.
Oh, damn it. So it can't be monkeys.
How would you try to solve this?
I mean, I'm actively trying to solve it right now.
Well, I mean, but what steps would you take, though?
You know what? I would set a trap. or a test. Maybe put up a camera. That would be the easy way. Yeah, you know what? I would. I would set up a little drop cam. There you go.
Okay.
Well, okay. Now, there
it's
we go.
Interesting that we have the solution.
Of course.
Freeze it.
It's paused. It's not playing.
Okay. So here's the bench. That's exactly what this guy did. Now, I want you to imagine this mystery in a world where you don't have drop cams. You don't have cameras and recorders.
So the 1980s, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's in the 1980s. And by the way, this does look like a well-used work desk. It looks like we've got some kind of Tupperware bin or maybe a cooler. But the whole desk is covered. You know, you go to a machine shop or something, maybe an auto parts local guy. Like every inch.
There's a lot of bric-a-brac.
Are we going to take bets now on what we're going to see?
Well, in England, it won't be a monkey.
Will it not? Dampen? I'm going monkey.
I'm going to go raccoon. I'm going to go raccoon.
All right.
Fact check. Are there raccoons in England?
There's got to be.
There's got to be, right? Only they're more civilized. Thing.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Maybe not. Someone in the chat says
FM,
no.
Or swear,
no, they're North American.
North American. Okay. So no, assuming no raccoons, what would be your second?
You know what? I'm going to guess it's a raccoon abroad. I'm sticking with raccoon. he's getting
with
credit.
Ricky Gervais.
Yeah.
All right. You guys want to play back here?
Oh, wait. Oh. They're native range, but they've been introduced in parts of, apparently, I think, Germany here.
Oh, okay. So he hopped on a ship, got his little raccoon passport out.
Yeah.
Ready? Here we go. Let's see what happens.
All right. So, oh my God, it's a rat. A
little mouse.
We watched a little mouse jump out of a box, and he's grabbing bits. And he just grabbed a pocket knife. He just grabs a pocket knife.
He
and
is
shoved a pocket.
He's doing like the reverse of the old TV show Supermarket Sweep. He's putting everything on the shelf where it goes as fast as he can, man. It's like there's money on the line. What is going on?
So this mouse, apparently what happens, some rodents is they're used to clearing spaces where they live or their environments because they're burrowing, right? In this case, people are saying, yeah, the mouse is just, he's like, I don't want this. Who left this here? I'm going to move this out of the way. I live here.
Wow.
And so the mouse is clearing these things. The amazing part is watching him pick up the pocket knife. Yeah. I wouldn't think that a mouse could pick up a pocket knife like that and just.
Well, it is the size of him.
It's for, the speed and intensity with which he's going to work that blows my mind. Like this mouse is on a mission. He's just like, oh, no, this won't do it at all. Wow.
This is an industrious mouse.
This is
a mouse that knows what the deal. I want to make this mouse the CEO of weird things.
So this brings us to can I throw a wild speculative discussion that I think we've touched on before, because I think we had a story about training ravens or crows to pick up like cigarette butts and crows. Trade it for food or whatever. And I think I mentioned, like, at a genetic engineering level, and maybe we're just retreading a place that we went before, but how good would you feel about which creatures would you feel good about genetically engineering to serve the interests of mankind? Like, whatever this mouse is, I guess in one reality, we would find another mouse that loves to clean up, and we would breed the two of them together, and eventually we'd create a race of super mice that only wanted to tidy everything. Or in a more sci-fi version, we would genetically engineer ants to like have a secret fourth prime directive that says also clean up all the cigarette butts or whatever. Like, where does your comfort with that sort of playing God end and it becomes awkward? Like, all of a sudden you're not cool with it. Because I assume, like, on the other side of that border is chimpanzees genetically engineered and neurologically programmed to be butlers, and all of a sudden you get like into that subservient slave race animal world, right? And I think we're all agreeing that that would not be great, but where's the middle line?
I don't know, Brian. Let's not jump to conclusions here.
I mean, look, it'd be great if it had free will and chose to work in partnership and in an agreement of free trade. But like, I want to explore like that middle area where it's weird. Like, I assume we're cool with dogs, right? We did that with dogs. We took wolves.
Like train them to do our bidding.
Yeah, we like we took wolves and we're like, hey guys, new job. You protect us. You we're always the alpha. You're going to be our security guards, our alarm systems. You're going to be willing to die to protect us. That's your new lot in life. Also, now you're going to get increasingly ridiculous and cute and pee on our rugs.
All opposed, raise your hand and say no.
Yeah. Yes, say the words. Well, I see a paw over here, but no. That doesn't sound like no to me.
100% consensus.
Yeah, no, okay.
I would say there are, you know, we use dogs now, like canine dogs, which help and save lives. But, you know, a dog doesn't know what it signs up for canine school. It gets to go play with other puppies and people and gets tasks and stuff. And the next thing you know, he's chasing down a meth head with a gun.
So,
yeah.
What if the news tomorrow says rogue genetic engineers in China have produced good news? White Bengal tigers are no longer an endangered species because they can all be grown in the lab. Also,
they're not really a species, though, Brian. It's a deformity.
Okay, whatever. Fine. But there's as many Bengal tigers as we want, but they're genetically engineered, and all they want to do is give your children rides around the neighborhood, and they will never, ever bite anything, and they eat tiger chow, and everyone can have them now. Like, do we immediately
celebrate?
Isn't
that Texas already, Brian?
Man, it's the Texas of my dreams. Are you kidding me? Actually, there's going to be so many tigers.
I think that's more Miami than Texas.
No, you know the thing about Texas? The largest population of tigers in the world is like in Texas.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
There's a bunch of people collecting exotic pets. It's kind of a problem when they get loose.
Yeah. Yeah, the number of tigers in Texas is insane.
Like, would we be happy about that? Of cracking that seal of all of a sudden any animal could be anything we want it to be?
I think sounds cool to me. I mean, a tiger you can go pet that's like, you know, we had an English Mastiff, and he was a sweet, sweet dog. You know, he was a sweet, big dog that weighed more than I did. And, you know, if you could do that with a big cat, I had to look after a big cat, you know, a mountain lion, and that was terrifying. So to know that this thing's natural instincts weren't to like go through my throat and rip it out, I'm like, yeah, sure.
2,000 tigers in the state of Texas. That is second most to India for the largest tiger population on the planet. And it looks as if there may or may not be more tigers in captivity in Texas than there are in the wild.
Yeah. Okay, how about this one? New announcement. Cirque du Soleil announces their new show. That takes place. You buy tickets and you line up on the Golden Gate Bridge, and they start playing music. And choreographed to the music are 30 orca and 20 blue whales that all dance on command.
What a change in management for Cirque du Soleil that built its whole name on not using animals in the light of, like, you know, Barnum and Bailey giving up animals. Cirque du Soleil is like, we're bucking the trend, folks.
Well, we're gonna
zag while the others zig.
Have you dealt with this many French Canadian acrobats? Really, I would rather deal with some killer whales.
but they're genetically engineered killer whales that absolutely love it. They're all happy. They're like, I was born for this. This is the best thing in the world. And they're all having, you know, secret relationships in the dorms where the killer whales stay in between shows.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that, like, so there's still SeaWorld or that we are just, like, breeding this new kind of whale that, like, you can
just
drop
wants.
In the and they just do the thing.
Correct. Like, they love the idea. They're thrilled. There's no nets, and all they want to do is dance and play on
they
command.
They all know that every day at 5, 7, and 10 o'clock, they get a bunch of food, and as many as are around will come and do the dance.
Right, and scientists come in, and they're like, we're looking at stress hormones, and these, of all the animals that have ever lived, they have the lowest stress hormones. They're clearly having the best time of their life. And look at this wonderful drama behind the scenes as the whales are hooking up behind the scenes, and then they all want to go to high school afterwards.
Based in whale dung. We have the happiest whales I've ever seen in my life, and look, they bang.
I mean, but you get what I'm saying, right? Like ascribe all of, I mean, we're cool with humans going and working for a Cirque du Soleil. And let's say you could genetically engineer a bunch of whales so that it was every bit as moral and ethical. In fact, more so because they're guaranteed abundance for life. Are we cool with that? Do we like that?
I think so. Yeah, there's certainly very little difference between that and I think how much we all understand breeding or purposeful breeding. The question would be, do the animals seem happy? If the animals seem happy, and we do have that overexcited whale doctor that is giving us the proof as best we understand it, then yeah, I think that there's very little.
Okay, is there a counter argument to somebody coming up and saying, hey, in the natural state, there would be 3 to 5 normal whales of whatever varieties in this space, and they've been crowded out by your freak monstrosities, your human-created Franken-whales, and now you're robbing nature of something by the mere fact of your weird whale and whale pony show over here?
Yes.
Literally is a pony riding a whale.
that's got to be like the last. Also, the pony's genetically engineered as well.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
Yay!
Pony from the moment it was born was thinking about the moment it would leap majestically from the shore onto the back of a whale.
Well, that was restaurant at the end of the universe. You know, Douglas Adams kind of they had the animal that wanted to be eaten, right? Mm-hmm. And I forget what he called it. And it enters sort of like in Douglas Adams' brilliant way was like the sort of subtly like, is that ethical to engineer a thing that wants to serve us? Like we, you know, whatever free will you had, we got rid of it and we're giving you a version of it, but one that suits us.
I mean, I guess modern economists would say that's a nudge because it's like, well, you have total free choice. You could do whatever you want. Just turns out what you want to do is the easiest thing that makes you the happiest, which happens to be doing exactly what works for us. I mean, that's like where does that line go? Because like, for example, organ harvesting, you know, whether you dig donating organs or not, it is a fact that you can increase the amount of available organs by creating an opt-out system where you have to actively take action to opt out versus selecting an opt-in system where you have to take action to opt in. So, like, I mean, that seems like a fair thing that preserves your free choice but causes an outcome. Theoretically, yeah, wouldn't this be just a version of that?
Negative rights and stuff too, though. That's the whole opt-out thing is kind of still, I'm a little, think about like when you make Unix.
Yeah, the operating system.
We're going to take this thing out at a point when you're born and you're not really going to notice. And later on in life, you know, I'm like, yeah, you're going to be great for, I don't know, singing, you know, soprano, being a palace guard for a bunch of my harem. And
so that's actually a really good question. Are the two moral equivalents, the amazing Cirque du Soleil show and the and creating castrati? No takes? Nobody wants to touch that.
I think that you know, they don't have to be equivalent, but they can be equal to or greater than or less than. They can be on the same. If we're considering this, why is this out of bounds? You know, have we moved out of bounds here?
God, but meanwhile, like the idea of creating a supermassive swarm of ants that just cleans up after every concert. It lives in the back and it only likes to come out at 3 a.m. And every single ant, all it lives to do is to pick up discarded.
I think you can make the moral argument if, like, you know, dogs that are raised, you know, domestic dogs live longer than ones in the wild, right? You know, their life expectancies have increased, right? Quality of life, you know, you let a dog get out, they tend to come back home. You know, they're not like, I gotta get out of here, I just can't handle it. They're like, no, can I come back in? You know, it's warm and you give me food. Dogs of their own, you know, ability to sort of determine seem to, and you can deal with like if they find food supplies elsewhere, whatever, maybe not, but you know, they like to be part of the human tribe because we've evolved them that way for sure. And I think if you could say the quality of life is better, I mean, I eat meat, you know, which I think the life, I would rather be a whale in Cirque du Whale than a chicken that gets consumed by me, you know.
All right, so I have a question. Is it a moral good to help another entity be more intelligent? We know it's a moral good.
I've tried, Brian. People just don't like it.
We know it's a moral good when it comes to our children. We aspire to make them as intelligent and as self-aware as possible. If you could do that, and I think we do that with dogs as well. We want our dogs to understand this is feeding time, poop outside the house, not in the house, all that stuff. But, like, would it be a moral good or bad thing to genetically engineer a carrot, as somebody in the comments is alluding to be more intelligent?
And there's an entire book of the Bible about this.
Oh, is it?
Adam and Eve. The apple, knowledge. You know, we didn't know we were naked until all of a sudden, hey, we ate ate from the tree of knowledge. Oh, wait, I'm naked. Wait, what's going on here? You know, and then all the badness started. I mean, that's the moral lesson from there. So
right. So ethically, boy, I didn't really think about that. Like,
we get into the tricky argument, right? Is that like, oh no? So morally, we should be restricting information. We should be restricting progress because that's the true gift of mercy. We are now on page one of the supervillain handbook.
Well, and so I assume, like, we would agree that it's a moral bad if you could wave a genetic wand and cause not only a carrot to have intelligence, but also self-awareness and full consciousness. And all it does is it grows as if a human does with a locked-in syndrome, not seeing or hearing or understanding anything, but just suddenly feeling agony beyond words when it's eaten by a rabbit or whatever. Like, that feels like a moral bad.
Unnecessarily cruel.
Well, it's but meanwhile, I'm trying to square that with the other side of the spectrum, where increasing consciousness and increasing awareness and increasing intelligence is a universal good.
I don't know that it is. I'm not saying that it's not. I'm just saying that, like, is there, you know, there seem to be, like, optimal levels of, like, if you're slightly more intelligent, we'll use IQs are extremely imperfect measures, but we use IQ as a measure. If you have a slightly higher IQ, you tend to be a little happier. Above a certain level, it doesn't seem like there's much of a correlation, you know, and in fact, at extreme levels, it might be even, you might even feel alienated, right? So we know there's a certain, there might be an optimum level, and it might have to do with the environment you're in. You know, if you're really high IQ and you're around a bunch of, you know, low IQ people, probably very frustrating. Maybe. I mean, you know, you're happier. Are you happier when you're a kid or when you're an adult?
That does bring up the other kind of moral thing, because we want our kids to be happy, but we also want them to, when they're older, feel contented. And oftentimes a contented life is one that consists of certainly some, possibly many, possibly extended periods of unhappiness that yielded or unpleasantness. You know, it's not pleasant to, you know, birth a baby, let's say. But we our kids to have those experiences.
Bryce brings up the book Flowers for Algernon, which was a great example of what happens when you raise somebody's intelligence level, but not their emotional intelligence.
I actually, for whatever reason, I've heard this title a million times. I know nothing about this book. Can you give me the
Did you see the movie Charlie?
No, I don't think I did.
Oh, wow.
Like,
So they take a guy who is below average intelligence, you know, and they give him a treatment or serum, whatever, and it makes him smarter and smarter and becomes very smart. And then he sees things very different and whatever. And there's a sort of tragedy. You know, Algernon's like, you know, I think the lab rat that he looks after. Or basically what happens is he starts to decline and whatnot and, you know, trying to figure out how to reverse it and whatnot.
He becomes aware of the people in his life who are he thought he was close with but were taking advantage of him. And he is it that he ends up regressing back to how he was, or does he die?
Spoiler alerts. All I can think of is
this is a short story from the 60s.
I'm just saying it's a spoiler alert for Brian. Me,
that's fine. That's
everyone
fine.
Else who hasn't read this.
It sounds a lot like Awakenings.
Well, I didn't know it was a short story before it was a novel. I didn't know that.
Yeah. They made like a I don't know if the film that they made for it was like a TV movie or just a cheap feature film, but I know I saw that in school, and that's an okay version of that story.
Yeah, no, he doesn't die, but he basically kind of develops, you know, he regresses dementia and all that until he's back. He remembers that he was smart once.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose this is the part I'm really wrestling with, is that there is no right answer, because even the idea of like IQ being more smart, like IQ is defined as your place on a spectrum of on a curve of all of humanity. And so, yeah, in general, it's better to be slightly smarter than the rest of your cohort. But once you introduce the theoretical genetic engineering and you could go to unlimited intelligence or unlimited anythings, it does get a little tweaked.
I'll say that, okay, like, so in the story, and then let me correct my bad attempt at trying to remember something I read 20 years ago. It's a surgery, and the surgery makes him more intelligent. He works at a bakery, and his problem, and a big part of the story I remember was his problem was his relationships with the people. I'm like, yeah, he doesn't have emotional intelligence. You know, he has this capacity now, and that can be a big problem, is that you can have – there are a lot of extremely high IQ people that are very emotionally emotionally developed, and they're fine. You know, they get along. But if you don't have an emotional development, and, you know, you don't have to go far than Twitter to see some very capable, famous, smart people who completely lack who you have blow-ups and whatnot in a way that you're like – how do you not realize you're smart? How do you not realize how you look, you know, or how you're reacting to other people?
Right.
And I think that's a factor. So if you can increase that, you know, the empathy, you know, one of the things I'm a big, big proponent of is understanding theory of mind, you know, understanding, seeing how other people see things. And it is undertaught. It's underrealized. It is the most useful skill that can be for developing relationships and understanding this theory of mind. And that is, how do other people see things? And then, you know, if you're just smart, if you're super smart and you think everybody's dumb, you have very poor theory of mind.
Yeah. Without getting much into it, I think it is a very, very key detail to understanding controversial issues like religion and politics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we solved that. Marvel movies. Sorry.
Sure. Or Marvel movies. But, you know, I did have a
theory of mind moment in which, you know, Josie needed a recommendation for what movie to go see. And I was able to be all like, you know what? I think you're really going to like Captain Marvel.
Oh, yeah.
Once I saw it through her eyes, I'm like, she's going to have a lot of fun. She's going to see these things.
Yeah. I have every one of my dude friends has a daughter or daughters. And they're like, what do you have Marvel? I'm like, take your kid. I'm like, take her. She's going to love it. You know, mm-hmm. And then tell her what's wrong.
Oh my God, my oldest was great. My test for Josie was, what did you think of Bumblebee? She was like, I loved it. It was great. I'm like, you're going to love Captain Marvel. Go watch Captain Marvel.
He's like, not enough John Cena. Anyway.
Wait, I liked Bumblebee. What does that say about me?
It
says that you can only find happiness by going to patreon.com/weirdthings. Yes, Andrew, your life is empty and meaningless until you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings, where you can support this show. Get a custom RSS feed that gets you our after show called After Things, in which we talk about our creative processes and take your emails. Folks, it's the best deal going today. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Did I cross a line there, Brian?
No. I think Justin saw that, that off-ramp right there, that leads to 20 minutes of not weird things.
More Captain Marvel talk.
Yeah, I was at Bumblebee. I like Bumblebee. Bumblebee is fine.
No, Bumblebee was fine.
Let me put it this way.
Minutes of Bumblebee talk.
I can say for a fact that Bumblebee is far and away the very best Transformers movie there's ever been. End of my statement. That is a truthful statement.
I just watched Age of Extinction the other night because I'm like, you know what? I have not seen every Transformers movie. That's the one that's missing. I've seen it now.
That is also a true statement of fact. Welcome to Factual Things.
Stanley Tucci looked great. Stanley Tucci was great. Moving right along. Let's change the topic from cloning and animals and stuff to the next item here, which, by the way, I didn't bring up the whole cloning thing. That was you, Brian.
Yep, no, that was definitely
me. The next topic is China has done something.
They're
still doing stuff?
Cirque de China? What are they doing?
They cloned something, guys. They cloned an animal for their benefit.
Tell me more.
Guys, when are they going to stop mucking around, these giant...
And this was sort of funny, because when he went on that tangent, I'm like, huh, well, this sort of goes, you know, with the body of this story, but I'm going to tell you what this is. So in China, they had this police dog named Kunshun, and he's like, as far as police dogs go, you know, actually, Kunshun is a clone of another dog. I got to get his names right. I don't know if they say with the other dog. The other dog was a super great police dog. Like, this dog was really good, easy to train, could find evidence, was just like a super all-around great police dog, right? And they're like, you know what? Instead of trying to go through a bunch of other dumb dogs, let's just take this dog and clone him. And so they clone the dog, and so now they have, you know, they're cloning police dogs.
Now, this is something that is more and more a part of our mundane life, right? Like, hasn't Barbara Streisand cloned her dog a couple times to make sure that she's never without her favorite pet?
Oh, my God. No, that's amazing. I didn't know that. I know that we talked.
The headline, New York Times, Barbara Streisand explains why I cloned my dog.
Penned by Barbara Streisand in 2018. A very recent article.
Two of them. Miss Violet and Miss Daisy are clones of the same dog. Oh,
Samantha. And by the way, the picture on that is the two dogs in a little doggy stroller at the ornate gravestone of the dog they were cloned from.
Oh, that's amazing.
She's just like us, guys. She's just like us.
We also talked... Man, this must have been...
Just ask her about Michael Jackson.
This must have been... It's topical. This must have been like 5 years ago, but we talked about, like, I think I shared with you guys a Wired article that I read that said that it's not legal to sell meat harvested from cloned cattle, but it is legal to sell meat from the offspring of cloned cattle. Like, the cloning process is problematic for the first generation, but if they make it through, they're what Stephen King in The Dark Tower called threaded stock, and then all of their offspring is available. So almost certainly, by the numbers, by the percentages, considering how much meat gets blended together, all of us have consumed the offspring of cloned cattle. Isn't that crazy?
Yummy.
Well, I mean, look, I this is just a part of our modern world, right? Like, this is and as Brian's pointing out, probably more of a part than we might even have wrapped our head around currently, that we're going to look back at some point, we're going to be old, and there's going to be some report showing exactly how much cloned meat we've eaten, and we're all going to say, well, I mean, none of us died, so cool.
Yeah. You can extrapolate this. One of the things that happened was when we tried to clone primates, we found out that there's a thing called methylation on DNA, which is extra kind of added in details on there. And without that, things don't really work out as well. And you've seen sometimes some of like the cattle where they had like twice the muscularity or whatever. So methylation, though, is a problem that is probably a very solvable problem. And that's going to be a thing where we haven't been cloning people yet, because that's been one of the stumbling blocks is, you know, with primates particularly, that's an issue. But once you solve that, you know, and there's crazy ideas for like you can use optics with negative indexes of refraction. So you can maybe theoretically build an optical scanner to sort of scan the methylation, et cetera. So
can you, in layman's terms, get me closer to understanding what the methylation process is?
So imagine you have DNA, but then you have a strand of DNA, but let's say the little proteins that are attached to it too, that also have extra information, like, no, stop it at this process. Like, you know, little extra information.
So this is all, and I'm on the outside. Tell me if I'm right about this. We increasingly over the last decade or two have learned the importance of proteins and how they shape by starting and stopping certain processes at certain mm-hmm. times. And this is why, when it comes to fighting diseases, something that theoretically you're like, well, it should work. It's because proteins are active or not active or so on. And wasn't there like a SETI at home project using distributed computing that did nothing but protein folding?
Yeah, protein folding, that was a big issue. And Tyler Rizal, who's the smartest person in this conversation right here, talks about epigenetics, and that's the term we want to use. Is basically epigenetics are the things that are basically outside the DNA but still important, that carry information and whatever through.
And things that make changes after birth. Would a caterpillar becoming a butterfly be an example of epigenetics, or?
There might be an environmental trigger that all of a sudden tells the genes which genes to switch on or whatever. And that's one of the things factors. You can have genes that are dormant, then all of a sudden something happens, you know, in there that says this. You know, people point out, you know, telomeres are more like the little thing, like stop replicating at this point. And somebody points out there.
Tyler Zarell said no, that's not an example of epigenetics. So my guess is she's typing now and we'll get something.
Yeah. So like, but that epigenetics is the information that's outside of the DNA strand. I don't know if we could explicitly say that it's, because if you find that in certain environments it doesn't happen or whatever, I don't know, but you know, more just the, you know, baby inside of the womb, you know, the mom is helping program the immune system.
Correct.
You know, and so if you're born into an environment and your mom is you're living in that environment, you might be more adapted to it when you're born. If you move a newborn to a radically different environment, it's harder for them to necessarily adapt because they didn't have a lot of these little things. So
on this police dog topic, I'm reading this article from Engadget here. They're saying he might be good enough to enter service in 10 months after training. The ultimate plan is to mass produce cloned dogs sometime within the next 10 years. How do we feel about that?
Yeah, they say that I guess it could take up to 5 years to train a dog, and they have a dog that learns in 10 years.
10 months.
I don't, I'm not,
10 months,
yeah. Yeah, 10 months. Sorry, thank you, Brian. And I'm not too concerned. It's not like this is a country that has a habit of like forced marriages and trying to engineer, you know, things. So I can't imagine a more human-centric country to take on this initiative.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of these things like, yes, we need to be exploring this and doing this. And I think that the more informed we all are in asking questions, not necessarily walking into things with opinions and trying to fit them to what we perceive the morality of it to be, but to ask questions to understand it, the better, like AI or anything. And it's this, you know, that we could stop it is, it's not going to, when you try to stop a thing, then only bad actors are the ones doing the thing.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Tally Zarell in the chat gives a clarification. She says, I mean, the epigenetics vary from parents, whereas a caterpillar would pretty much always be oriented to become a butterfly at some point. Maybe that transformation is mediated through epigenetics, but I doubt that it would be something dependent on methylation and other post-translational modification because they're not as permanent or stable as DNA. That makes sense.
I heartily agree. Because I'm not in a position to say. Well,
I'm glad she finally got on the same page we were.
Yeah, well, but the thing is you might find when you've seen radical changes in, let's say, butterfly wing colors and stuff, like remember, like all of a sudden all the butterflies matched the color of suit and stuff like that.
Those
might be examples of an epigenetic modification where there's some trigger or something in there that makes it easier to adapt.
Yeah,
maybe.
What was the news story where it's like that was a canonical story of selective biological pressures for Darwinian fitness, but in fact it sounds like that's like new stuff says no, that's not it at all.
You know, maybe, you know, one of the things that affects, like they talk about plasticity, and that is if your mom is a small woman, your womb is only so big, right? And so you're going to be shorter. And then you looked at like these post-World War II births where you had a generation after World War II, like, oh, they're big because of nutrition. And the next generation was even taller, even though they had poor nutrition. It was because their mothers were healthy and they had larger wombs. That's the story, at least. And they were able to, you looked at birth weights increased.
Right.
You know, and these are things that the DNA didn't change, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, vote. Genetic dog cloning en masse in China. Are we for it or against it?
I mean, I think the process itself, I think, is inevitable. Like we're just going, we are getting to that place, and the science is going to be reliable enough that I'm for it, and I am for us actively developing our ethics around it.
Yeah, the only downside is that. is I only worry about crowding out the ecosystem, because in general, you want ecosystems to be as biodiverse as possible. In fact, we mentioned this before, but Kim Stanley Robinson's Aurora is all about this in the context of a space arc. And I worry that the simplicity of just growing a crop of clones that are the best will crowd out the space for more diversity.
I understand that point, but like, I don't think we need to worry about that with like dogs, when there are dogs filling so many different niches and niches too. And I would say that in the case of something like for police dogs, worth doing, like, yeah, I want us to be doing more of this. I want us to be, you know, doing a lot more of this, you know, so that we can, you know, understand and be aware of it. But you know, there's, yeah, you divert, biodiversity is a helpful thing, because when you have something that can go through and wipe away everything, but also you don't want to use that as an example, not to, because you're not, you know, but like, oh, we shouldn't do, you know, genetically modify organisms, because then they all become homogenized and more susceptible to disease. Like, or we pass on a trait that makes everything much more resistant and helpful, you know?
Yeah.
So, this sounds like how you get the dogs from Resident Evil. You just keep cloning them, and then they turn into these zombie things.
Yeah.
But yeah, whatever, bigot.
Yeah. I got one more story. Kind of another this is the future's kind of cool and weird. Microsoft announced something. Actually, I think it came out in December, but I didn't hear about it until like a week or so ago. Text World. You're like, what's Text World? Imagine a text game. Imagine a computer-generated text game that could generate, like, you're in a room. There's a key on the door, and there's a doorway. And, you know, what do you do? Go north, go south, grab the key, do this, okay? Text World generates these on the fly. You say how many rooms you want to have, 8 rooms, 9 rooms, whatever. And it creates it, right? You know, it spontaneously generates these rooms that can be navigable. Very easy to do. Like, you're literally, you do a PIP install, and then, you know, pip install. Next thing you know, you've got the thing up and running, one command line in your generated room. Now, you read these, like, it's kind of boring. You're in a house. There's this on a table. And you're like this. It's like, well, this is sort of not the most exciting text adventure ever. It's not for you guys. So stop judging.
Oh,
it's
this
for
is...
training rope.
Yeah. So in other words, it's training the AI. We are the data points that allows the AI to figure out, like, okay, in general, people want to know if they can hump the desk or peel the paint off the walls or whatever.
Or in even more simple terms, it's like, can the AI figure out like how to navigate? It says, oh, I need a key to open up a door. Yeah, but yeah, like, yeah, you know, it's basically let the AI play the game and develop it. You can do, you know, reinforcement learning, where it gets better and better each time at learning how to navigate and play the game. And then you can make it more and more sophisticated.
God damn. I guess it's something we have to actually install in order to play live on the air.
You can see some examples of that. I was thinking about doing doing an install on it to show. But if there's a video attached to it, which shows you.
There's a getting started. Here we go. Here's something on their website. All right. This is Text World. I'll read this out. You are hungry. Let's cook a delicious meal. Check the cookbook in the kitchen for the recipe. Once you're done, enjoy the meal. You find yourself in a backyard. You make out a patio table, but the thing is empty. You see a patio chair. Wow, isn't Text World just the best? The patio chair is stylish, but there isn't a thing on it. You see a gleam over in a corner where you can see a barbecue. There is a closed screen door leading south. There is a closed wooden door leading west. There is an exit to the east. Don't worry, there is no door.
So is this interactive? Can we type, or this is just a photo?
Wait, I thought it was. No. It says it is.
Yeah, so here, type go east, I guess.
Well, that assumes my keyboard does it.
Okay.
Okay, well, let's assume we said
But I think we get the idea of it.
Yeah.
It is interesting to... We are accustomed to the idea of procedurally generated 3D worlds, and we are accustomed to the idea of procedurally generated 2D worlds. But I don't know why we skipped over the idea of text. Maybe to us, you know, mammals, monkeys, it feels like the symbolic transformation of words to 3D space. I guess that feels like a blind spot. It feels like we should have had this first, right?
Navigating text. The earliest AI stuff was trying to figure stuff out. Semantics, understanding semantics, intent and stuff, and that natural language processing is very much, you know, it's the heart of it is that, and now trying to understand context. And, you know, a big part of what a lot of you know, research, like, you know, trying to understand what is this, you know, article sentiment? What is the article saying here? You know, every time you talk to one of your voice assistants, it's trying to understand what the hell you want.
Yeah.
You know, can you get your intent on that?
So Bryce is playing the game right now.
Yeah, we got it.
Can you do weird stuff like kick the table or?
Sure. So we made it to the kitchen. There's a fridge, an oven, a table, counter. You want to kick? Let's try kick table.
Yeah, kick the table.
That's not a verb I recognize.
Okay. A worship the table.
Pick up knife. Pick up knife.
Sure. Pick up knife.
Pick up two words. Yeah, there you go. Knife.
You take the knife from the counter.
Throw knife.
You drop the knife on the ground.
Oh, that's not bad. It's got at least that much.
Throw knife at oven.
Futile.
Okay, so I understand this is not a super sophisticated, like, in, you know, it's a basic, you know, most of your techs of interest have this level of intelligence, whatever. What's special is that this is a tool for just generating these endless amounts of these rooms and environments and stuff. So if you have, if you want to have your AI try to figure out how to solve these things, you create a, you know, million of these things.
All right, look, I'm wise to what you're up to, Microsoft. How long till this becomes a cyber sex bot where it's nothing but a back and forth sexy conversation about what you would do to someone in front of you?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's going the other way. I think we're training him to be like, you know, comic book guy. He's a D&D player. You know, he's going to be.
Oh, that would be great. Actually,
I'm a mage level 57. And I think that.
Yeah. You know, what's funny is I was talking on Twitter a few months ago about, like, you know, what if just there was an open ended anything and a human was just, you know, making up the story. But that's exactly what they're trying to automate here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which all of this just makes me.
Could you do an AI chatbot that just argued with you about movies?
Ooh.
Like, yeah. just like, oh, like it, the prompt would always be, what's your favorite movie?
I think I would enjoy that as long as it was programmed not to enrage or be right or whatever, but to enlighten me. Like, get me to understand why Captain Marvel was a good movie.
No, you just feed it negative reviews. Of every movie on the planet, and it just synthesizes into bite-size, you know, problems with every movie that's ever existed.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're gonna get to, you know, a point where we're trying to do things right now. Like, you can have movies that are very good to understand what's going on in the scene, because you can, or you have programs that can understand what's going on there now. Like, because if you're looking at the software that says, oh, two guys arguing, you know, two man and a woman wrestling on top of a mattress, you know, it doesn't quite get everything. But they're getting better, and you could start to feed it movies, and it could start to figure out, like, oh, well, this happened, and that happened, this happened, and that happened, and it got this score, so I guess this is good.
I just realized that Justin literally pitched Max Trollbot, like a robot programmed with all the most heinous negative reviews.
I think Captain Marvel was bad. Prove me wrong.
Picks?
Have you guys watched enough for us to talk a little bit about Love, Death, Robots? I watched a little bit more of that
today. I have not a single frame of it.
Oh.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's my pick. It continues to be confusing to me because I don't know why I keep watching it. Like, every single episode, I think... Yeah, that was pretty transparent and obvious and maybe would have impressed me when I was 12. I think it's just designed for 12-year-old boys.
About the algorithm and how it plays them for you?
Yeah, they're like randomly assigning different accounts different episode orders. So they've said that there are four different ways that the episodes can be ordered. And Netflix has said that they are not tied to any information that they have about you, despite... Some.
I was gonna say, if we have it, Netflix thinks Brian's a 12-year-old boy.
Maybe so. Also,
but they're all the shorts are like. I mean, they're selling this as a mature.
Is broken. Like I can't. This morning, mm-hmm. like I had taken a week long break since I had watched any, and I clicked on episode 5, and then it gets to the end, and it says next episode, and I'm like, great. I let it auto go to the next episode, goes back to episode 1. And then keeps doing that after every single show. Like, I have to go to the menu.
I did have that happen once also, where it wanted to send me back to the first one. But it does have. It did keep my position in some of the other ones, but it definitely is not perfect.
Yeah. So the I don't know. Like, I don't want to say it's bad. It's just everything about it is cliche. And part of me, I think, loves it because it makes me nostalgic for when I was 12 years old. And I remember getting science fiction anthologies, you know, like, you know, Young Aliens or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was all short story. When you think about those 3 to 20 page short stories that you would get in those old pulps, like, that's what this feels like. And, you know, when you only have 12 to 20 minutes, there's not really much of a thing you could set up. And I wonder if it's just an artifact of me having read a lot of science fiction that the moment the first idea comes up, I instantly assume, you know, it's like, well, the obvious thing would be to make it this. And then it turns out to be exactly that. But, like, looking past it, where it's like I'm not grading it on the quality or the depth of the storytelling, it's like, all of them are obvious. None of the twists are surprising. But I can't know what it looks like to somebody who hasn't heard versions of this story before.
Sure.
You know, somebody who hasn't already heard the idea of, you know, beautiful ex-girlfriend turns out to be alien intelligence or whatever.
You know, it's a very, very good point. I'll make the argument that if it's really well told, you'd be fine watching it anyways, because you're like, I know this. Oh, I love this way it's done. And it is the curse of knowledge. And that's, you know, I got excited when they were going to do, like, Sci-Fi Channel is going to do George R. R. Martin's Night Flyers as a TV series. Cause, like, I love the story, and I actually dug the 80s movie because it was kind of a cool, different thing. And then I'm like, yeah, cause it's so much more than just, you know, what happened on this spaceship. Everything's weird. And then it's like, nope. Every sci-fi story in space now is that, you know, it's the Mary Celeste. They all do that. And it drives me nuts because it's like, it feels fresh. If you've never watched anything in science fiction and you have no idea, you know, from limb on forward of the haunted space station or spaceship, you know, it's one of these things like there are a number of tropes, which is why Rick and Morty is so amazing, because it's like, they know all the tropes, and a minute into it, they're like, yeah, we know this is a trope. We're going to use this to go totally to the different way.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's an issue of depth, right? Like, I think even outside of the structure of having, you know, a sci-fi story with a twist at the end, like, there's not enough depth. And it could be because these are short and you don't have a lot of time to dive into these worlds. But also, like, some of the writing's just not great. And
Agreed. And there have been a couple that, despite, you know, everything being fairly transparent, I was like, that was still pretty great. And some of it, they do well on the world building. What's the one with, like, the succubus
A Good Hunting.
Yeah.
Good Hunting is very, very good.
I thought that was a really good one. And I liked Suits a lot, even though it's just a straight up video game.
It's Fortnite.
But the animation is gorgeous on all of these. And again, here's the part that kind of breaks my heart is I would love to share any of these with my 15-year-old daughter, but the gratuitous, no parent wants to recommend any of these to their kids, and their teenage kids are the target demographic for all this. So I guess I don't know. It's so, like, even the cutesy, like puppy, the yogurt one, where they, like, for some reason, let's just, you know, show an angry woman flashing her tits for no reason that contributes nothing to the story. Sure. Outside of checking that box of having tits in there. What are you doing?
But also, I think as a parent, you would maybe not, you would not want to show this to your kids. But also, if your kids have Netflix, they could find it.
Oh, no, but actively, right. I know Penny won't like it.
Oh,
She will be very put off. She was like, why are you doing this amount of cartoon gore for nothing that adds to the story?
Yeah.
Why am I watching pretty much straight up pornography of a very high resolution sex? I mean, that is this close to being straight up Pornhub on there. You know, she wouldn't like it. And meanwhile, I feel like I want her to experience all of these classic, obvious tropes. But I can't recommend it to her because she won't like it. And I'll feel weird telling her she has to watch it.
I bet you could guide her. I don't think you could be like, hey, check out this thing and leave her to her own devices. But I bet you could, like, cherry pick and say, okay,
I did. I handed her Three Robots is the one story that I was able to hand her. Everything else had.
You know, there's a lot of other great anthology science fiction out there too, Brian.
Yeah, true. but also none of them currently in the cultural gestalt. None of them of the quality of animation that we're seeing on this. I mean, there are things that it does very, very well, which only makes it more painful that they veered into territory that was so unnecessary and doesn't yield any benefit.
But imagine if you had a 15-year-old son and not Penny, right? Like would that be a different? I mean, because a lot of the sensibilities that you're talking about are very specific to Penny.
Sure.
If there was a different sense of sensibilities, then maybe you could gleefully recommend it, knowing that it was a little bit of weird and naughty and something that you that they would enjoy.
Yeah, and again, like it's just heavy metal. If you saw heavy metal as a kid, that's what it's like.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
All right.
Watch Deadwood. I saw the trailer for the Deadwood movie. I really like the trailer for the Deadwood movie. Go watch Deadwood. I don't know why some people haven't seen it. It's crazy, man. That show is great.
Yeah, is that I have not seen a frame of Deadwood. Is the teaser good?
Yeah, I mean, the trailer, I don't mean, I'm so unrepentantly in love with the show, they could literally just have Sheriff Bullock and Elswerage and farting at each other, and I'd be super excited to watch it. But beyond that, go check that out. And oh, another one. Veep is coming back. Final season of Veep. I wound up getting into a little bit of a Veep hole when I was read the Entertainment Weekly article about them putting together the final season. But it is just so vulgar and so funny and such a, in my mind, Armando Iannucci, who did that and In the Thick of It, just has such a beat on the world, the vain world of politics, this like cartoonish element of politics and political figures and how government works, that I love, mostly because it just lampoons the sepia toned brave man fighting through the gridlock kind of mythology that the Aaron Sorkins of the world like to rhapsodize about, which has its own moments and merits, but man, it's also just good to see a bunch of slimy lizard people curse at each other.
Yeah, I didn't know that was coming up. That's what, next week?
I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a pick. I'm surprised I'm the third person in line and the first person to mention this. I went and saw Us this weekend, and it is a crime that the three of you have not yet.
Oh my God, is it that good?
It's very, very good.
Oh, that's wonderful. Us is, you know what?
This is the new Jordan Peele movie from the writer-director of Get Out.
Yeah, I should have gone by myself to see it yesterday. Yesterday, I finally had my first day off in like 2 weeks. Dang it. And of course, like my wife wouldn't want to go. My kids wouldn't. Maybe I'll do that tonight.
We were gonna see it. Couldn't get a seat. Yeah. So I'm gonna ask you a question though, Bryce.
Sure. And I'm not gonna spoil anything. I'm not gonna spoil anything.
No. On a scale of Get Out.
A scale of Get Out to what?
Oh no. Get Out. I assume is the high end because Get Out was very good.
Where would you put that?
Oh, zero to Get Out.
Yeah. How many in the number of units expressed as Get Outs? How many Get Outs do you give it?
So it's a kind of different direction, not even direction, it's a different sort of thing than Get Out is, but I think it's like 90% of a Get Out.
All right, so I'll be disappointed. Okay,
well,
I like Get Out, but I'm like, I think Jordan Peele's a great director and all that, but when I got to the end of Get Out, I'm like, really? Like, this is the conceit.
That is where you and I take different paths, because I loved the fact that it took that direction.
I understand, but I'm like, this is the longest Key and Peele sketch I've watched. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, it's a Key and Peele sketch. Which is not a bad thing.
Sure. But no. I mean, it's like both of those movies are if they're not horror films, they're horror adjacent. And I've been reading a lot of the various criticisms online, and it feels very weird to like try to apply realism to horror. Like, no one's out here asking how a clown is living in the sewers and right. why no, that, but, doesn't, but, hey, it, that doesn't. Hey, that doesn't. I would. You know.
The yes, and the thing is, though, is that if it's true to it's the rules of the universe. If something's true to the rules of the universe, then you're fine. You know, mm-hmm. like if you're if the characters are consistent and behave in the world like as you would think they would behave, then you go, okay, this is fine. Like sure. You know, you watch a ghost story, like ghosts are real in this, and what would they behave like real people would towards that? That's my
sure.
If they're like, you know, that's my criteria.
Yeah, and you know, the discourse that I'm reading online is not even always at that level. So,
I read a glowing review, like as like that it was like a once in a generation a movie about mm-hmm. the American family from Breitbart.com today. So oh, yeah. I think it certainly has a weighty kind of intellectual bent to it, at least in the vague descriptions that I read in the review. Obviously, you would not assume that Breitbart.com would be the place where the black event of the movie season would be lauded as something that is absolutely go take your family to see. Yeah. But I'm pumped to see it. I didn't check it out.
Yeah, I'm pumped too. I love Jordan. I think he's brilliant, and I also think that he's great that he's at this point, kind of like M. Night Shyamalan was at the height, where he can make stuff that nobody else can make. You know, he can do mm-hmm. stuff because he's able to, like, executives aren't going to shut him down and make him do something more mundane or whatever, sure. You know. Get Out, I love the fact that it was risky for what it was trying to do and the premise and stuff. And I'm like, nobody else can make this movie right now, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed – I mean, there's so much that's good about Us that I'd love to talk about in a spoiler in time or on a spoilery talking segment. Though also I think the reason I ding it is because I know there are a couple of things in the film that all three of you are not going to like, probably just based on, well, I don't know. I think I can think of a thing that you guys aren't going to like about the film, but, it's still,
I will definitely see it. The only reason why I didn't see it this weekend was because my father-in-law was in town. So we were like playing, Forest Host, but, that is on the list. That is on the list of things to go see.
Two thumbs up.
Cool. No, I definitely want to see it.
Andrew, you got a pick?
I got a pick. My pick, we saw this Apple announcement. They talked about the Amazon credit card and all that. Or excuse me, the Apple credit card. It reminded me of, I use the Amazon one because like I buy about everything from Amazon. And so if you're, you know, just to consider if you need a credit card, want to use a credit card, the Amazon one. If you have it enabled with Prime, whatever, you get 5% back on all of your purchases from Amazon itself. And then it's like, you know, 3% in other, like restaurants and then, you know, whatever the percentage is. I find it great. I'm one of these people, I just pay off the balance every month. So it's like I'm getting 5% back on most of my purchases and stuff. So if you're thinking about a credit card and using Amazon a lot, it's great. You know, when Apple comes out with theirs, it sounds like it'll be interesting. But anyhow, I just wanted to point that out. Because I've sometimes talked to people like, oh, the Amazon one, do you? I'm like, I get 5% back on everything on Amazon.
It looks like they have a couple of Amazon cards. There's a Chase one. Oh, maybe this is the same one. I don't see the 5%. I see the 3%. So maybe it's
there's,
a different deal.
If you're Amazon, if you have it with, if you're a Prime member, there's an Amazon Prime member version that gets you 5% back.
Oh, I see.
It's at least that's what I get. You know, I double checked that too, just because I was trying to see like what are the conversions. So that obviously is the one to get, I think, if you buy a lot through Amazon.
Cool.
All right. It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.